and welcome to this week's episode of House of Comments. My name's Emma Burnell and I'm a political journalist, and I'm joined this week by Nick Dennis of the Tory Workers Group. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Emma. How are you doing?
I am very well, thank you. And we don't have any Mark with us this week. So if anyone mentions AV, it will be up to you, Nick, to do the klaxon. But hopefully that won't happen.
I can hear all our listeners on Tenterhooks to see if AV will be mentioned or not in this podcast.
So we thought we'd start. We're recording this on Sunday, the 13th of May, and we all woke up this morning to the very sad news that Dame Tess Gyal has passed away. She had inoperable brain cancer and was incredibly brave in the last months of her life, speaking out in the House of Lords and really sort of championing cancer patients and cancer treatment within the NHS. And I don't think it would be right for us to do a podcast like this without just marking the moment, marking her extraordinary career and contribution to public life. And I think what has been so incredible is that the tributes have come from across the political spectrum. You know, as many people from the Conservative Party bearing witness to contribution that she made to public life and to politics as there were from her own party in Labour. And even, you know, again, sometimes we can all feel very bitterly divided, but there have been lovely tributes to her from John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn, very much not her wing of the party. But it's days like today when we all realise how much more we have in common than what divides us. Wouldn't you agree, Nick?
Of course, yeah, no, definitely. I mean, obviously, with anybody passing away, it makes you reflect on sort of the humanity and the human nature of what we're doing, really, rather than sort of, you know, sort of throwing sticks at each other in normal life. But I think even more so with Tessa Gyal, she was definitely somebody who almost transcended sort of party politics, certainly towards the end when she very bravely let us all into the experience that she was having, an experience that many people have in terms of getting severe cancer and how to fight against it. So, you know, she was one of those few politicians who definitely went beyond just party politics in terms of her identity.
Mm. And, you know, she had extraordinary achievements as well. I think without Tessa Gyal, it's fair to say that we probably wouldn't have had the 2012 Olympics. And I think the thing that she was proudest of was Sure Start, and just giving that amazing start in life to so many children. And it's something I think we can all really truly embrace. And, you know, I don't think, you know, there are obviously political questions that you and I might on other days have a ding dong about in terms of Sure Start. But I think today we should just say just a big thank you to Tessa Gyal for everything that she gave us in public life.
And it's a great reminder that in politics you can do good stuff and positive stuff that helps lots of people. You know, she is somebody who, I mean,
absolutely,
just those two things that you mentioned are two very sort of big important things that have, you know, helped improve many people's lives in different ways. So, you know, it sort of shows you we don't often, because we're too busy shouting at each other, I think, often sort of recognise actually, you know, the positive benefit politics can play to people in our society. So it's good that you brought those two things up, Emma.
Absolutely, absolutely. So as I said, I didn't want to start today's political discussion without taking a moment to remember a really incredible woman and someone who lived life absolutely to the fullest right to the very end. So Dame Tessa Gyal, thank you very much. So that was the nice bit. we are now obviously going to go back to the ding-dongs. So, speaking of ding dongs, where are we on the customs union, Nick?
Well, basically, yes, I have to admit, if you're going to push me on where I am on this subject, I am in the group of people who would have been hopeful that we would have got this sorted out between ourselves before we triggered Article 50, because it seems pretty much fundamental to the Brexit process and the fact that this discussion is still happening at the highest levels of government when we're pretty close towards the leaving date is not good. Because the truth is, whatever is decided amongst ourselves has to be negotiated, and that will change through negotiations. negotiations, of course, as well. And whatever is decided in the end would have to be implemented. And that takes time because government's a big tanker. Brexit is an extremely complicated process with lots and lots of things that need to be done, and this, you know, the catchphrase or whatever that the bandwidth of government is full with Brexit, so they can't do much else, is very true from my experience of dealing with government. So it is, you know, I mean, for me, beyond the questions of where we should and shouldn't be in the customs union, or I mean, I'm happy to go into those as well. The fact that we're in this place and this discussion is being had, and two small working groups are being set up to look at different options. Neither of the options, seem to be getting massively glowing reviews from many people, but it is quite disturbing, really.
Yeah, I mean, this is what concern, beyond the fact that I think Brexit's a bad idea. I mean, yeah, that's just on the table. We know that I think Brexit's a bad idea, but we also know that it was voted for and we're going to have to do it. So yeah, I mean, just for me, I'm just really concerned that, you know, we triggered Article 50 without really having any clue as to the roadmap of what we wanted, what kind of trading relationship we want with the EU, how we were going to deal with complications like the Irish border, you know, really important things. And there was no, this all sort of shut up and don't ask questions because it's unoptimistic and it's unpatriotic seems to have won the day, which is such a bad way of going into a negotiation. And I just have so little confidence in our negotiators. Now, I want a good outcome because the people who'll be hurt by a bad outcome are the people I care about. You know, they're the people at the sharp end. So we have to try and get the best possible outcome. But I am going to be a realist about how slim a chance I see of us getting that at the moment and how that appears to be narrowing with every misstep that's taken.
I mean, part of the problem is that no one knows what the best possible outcome is because Brexit is such an unknown thing. From trying to sort of figure out what the best outcome would be is an extremely difficult process. And of course, every single part of it as well is not just about analysing data and trying to extrapolate that into what might may or may not happen onto a situation that is completely unknown. So there is no real previous evidence of what might happen because of Brexit. But everything's also completely heavily laden with politics as well, which makes the debate really difficult, really. So, I think, you know, Brexit is causing the Conservative Party an existential crisis. And I know Brexit's bigger and more important than the Conservative Party, certainly. But because we are forced to actually come up with decisions and negotiating positions, unlike Labour, who are sort of able to fudge things at the moment and sort of try to get everybody to sort of fudge it in such a way that people who are pro Remain sort of think that Labour are sort of on their side and all this sort of stuff. We actually have to come down somewhere. It's really challenging us as a party. So I just don't see. I don't know where this is all going to end up, to be honest, Emma. Hopefully not another election next year, because I think that's. I mean, because again, the last election, showed that people were uncertain by the fact that no party had a particularly strong mandate. And if a snap election was called tomorrow, I don't believe that will change very much. It's possible a few sweet seats would go either way, but we would still have this essentially hung parliament, and I think we'd still have. We wouldn't have any extra clarity of what should and shouldn't be done.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I was thinking the other day, there's that sort of saying that political journalists like to comfort themselves with, which is the electorate basically tend to get the result that they want. And so we had a quite close referendum, and then we had a very close general election. And I'm wondering if what the public is basically saying is, do Brexit. We voted for it. We think it should happen, but don't go mad with it. We'd like a strong and left-wing opposition, but we'd like them in opposition. We want your feet held to the fire, but we don't trust you to actually run it. That would be kind of how you could interpret recent results.
Well, I'm going to go for a more simple interpretation, Emma. I think both results of Brexit and the last election result really was the electorate saying politicians have pain.
Well, there is also that, yes. I think we're a very divided country. I don't think it's just politicians have pain, but everybody just go back to your corners.
Yeah, no, it is extremely difficult. I mean, Labour are sort of hiding, and not hiding, I suppose. I think it's pretty obvious, but it's not like Labour have got any clearer answer on these questions particularly.
I mean, as you know, I'm not a big fan of the Labour fudge.
No, indeed.
This is
indeed.
I would say that my position is much clearer than the Labour front benches.
I mean, so from my sort of very simplistic level, I mean, I think the Brexit vote was a vote to leave the European Union and the institutions of the European Union. So I think that does mean leaving the customs union and leaving the single market and leaving the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. But what is very uncertain is then what future relationships are formed. I mean, I sort of like this idea of extending the transition arrangements in a sense that we can get to doing all the technical stuff about leaving, but then sort of be paused for a couple of years while we then really decide what sort of trading arrangement, customs union, we have in the future. And I think part of the problem right now is the debate is very mixed up between leaving and what we want next, which makes it even more complicated than it would be anyway. So that's probably sort of roughly in a very simplistic way the way I would go.
I mean, I think at risk of you sounding the klaxon, this was a first past the post vote on what essentially needed to be an AV referendum. not a referendum on AV. We had one of those and that was very clear, thank God. But, there was such a myriad of possibilities. It was a very close election. So the idea that the result is winner takes all, we leave everything, we go as far away, we have the hardest possible Brexit, it's not necessarily the result that everybody who was on the knife edge between the 48 and the 52 would want. So, I mean, I've argued before, I can see a better argument democratically, though not economically or socially, for leaving the single market. But I do think there is a compromise to be made on the customs union. I do think, particularly with the Northern Irish issue, that should be where there is more give. And at least at first, at least until you can work out what the hell else you're going to do, just say, you know what, we'll stick with it for now. And then we'll go off and we'll make the other bits of Brexit work. Why does it have to be just this thing that you shove it all in at once when we know that we haven't got the capacity to do it all at once?
Yeah, I think we certainly don't have the capacity to do it all at once. And also, the other tricky thing, the sort of thing that's sort of not mentioned so much is the, I know rules can be bent and broken, but the European Union rules are they're not allowed to negotiate separate trading arrangements with fellow other EU countries, because obviously all EU countries have the same trading arrangements. So in essence, until we leave and we have the transition period, we can't actually really properly negotiate a future trading arrangement with the EU. So I know the reality is probably a bit more complicated than that. But I mean, I suppose from a very broad perspective, I mean, I always thought that leaving the EU, Brexit, would mean leaving the customs union and the single market and the European Court of Justice. And for me, that was quite clear as what was on the ballot paper, because that is the EU, essentially. I think we need to probably do that well. And then, I hate to say, because I know I said I didn't want one, but then maybe have another election with parties presenting what they want from the future. And then maybe letting the country decide that in that way.
That's a possibility. But I mean, what that means is basically going into this completely free for all. We don't know what's happening.
Yeah,
and then
Brexit.
Potentially going to the election. Well, yeah, but it's Brexit for the insulated, for those who are not insulated from that. That's a hell of a risk.
Well, but the thing is that is Brexit. I mean, there is no precedent for Brexit. There's no understanding what Brexit really means. No one's ever done it before. So I think, you know, to do it is to jump into the unknown, which is, I mean, ultimately, I think Brexit is actually an unconservative thing, unfortunately. And, you know, lots of other conservatives don't agree with me, because actually it is ripping up the status quo and jumping, or diving headfirst into the unknown. I can't see any other way around it, really.
I think there are ways around it, But I'm not sure that there are ways around it that are acceptable to the hard Brexiteer wing of the Conservative Party, or whether there are ways around it that are passable by the House of Commons. And this is the problem. We're in an absolute stalemate. And I don't know. At the moment, Theresa May is very much siding with the hard Brexiteers. And she's, as we know from her nature, once she's sort of picked a side, she goes pretty hard on it pretty much permanently. I mean, that's what happened. That's why we've got such a mess over immigration. But there is just no political solution to, I mean, ultimately, frankly, David Cameron should be put up against a wall and talked to very loudly because I don't believe I'm shooting people.
You're not going to buy his memoir when he publishes it.
Funnily enough, I suspect I will not. I might go and deface it in a library, but no, it's just, I mean, I think in history, when in 200 years' time, people will look back and say that David Cameron was the single worst prime minister that this country's ever had, because the state that he's left us in is so appalling. And, you know, it's all down to his arrogance that we are here. And, you know, you can talk about the arrogance of Boris and Michael Gove and all the others all you want. But at the end of the day, David Cameron was the one holding the pen and he dropped the ball, just to mix my metaphors massively there.
That must have hurt his feet, whichever one he dropped. But that's all. I mean, that, Emma, that, you know, there is a strong argument for that. But ultimately, you know, that has nothing to do with going forward, does it now? So unfortunately, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the House of Commons. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm completely anti-referendums in the future because I don't think they heal the country or, you know, do particularly well. And I think that the referendum should sort of show us that. But what's going to be really interesting, I think, is going to be the Commons. You know, who's going to blink? What compromises are going to be made? When it comes to the crunch, if you're going to defy the government's line, it means that there's going to be a general election. Are people going to force a general election? Are enough people? Now that's going to be the really interesting moment.
Now the interesting question is how much the local election results will influence that, because Labour not doing as well as it seemed they should have done after the 2017 general election, does that strengthen the hand of Leavers or Remainers? Now I've heard arguments for both, but in terms
of neither. Right, because I think the election. I mean, I've been banging on about this. You know, it was about bins, not Brexit. And somebody who, conservative in Hillingdon, where people were saying that we might lose our seat, or you know, lots of people said we would lose our control, but we ended up increasing our majority over Labour. You know, Brexit wasn't mentioned, and we certainly didn't mention it. We talked about bins, not Brexit. And I think in a really funny way, because national politics is so messed up, and neither main national parties looked upon that favour. It actually meant this local elections was very much focused on local issues, funnily enough. So I don't think anybody should read anything bigger apart from local issues. And that's just my experience anyway. So,
I mean, I think that would be nice, but it's not generally how local elections work, sadly, much as I think they should work that way. But whether or not that is how people voted, we all know that local election results are then filtered into national political conversations. And if it looks less like Jeremy Corbyn's going to romp home at the next election, does the shell shock that might have steadied the hand of some of the more ardent Remainers, does that slightly go, maybe we're not so worried about triggering an election?
But the thing is, what manifesto will the Conservative Party fight? I mean, in order to do that, the Conservative Party obviously needs to come up with a manifesto, which will state what it's going to be doing on these very complicated issues. I mean, if the cabinet themselves can't even agree on fundamentals right now, imagine the manifesto drafting process. it's just going to be, especially if it's a snap election and we've got 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever. I mean, what is going to happen? I don't know. It's just going to be, I don't know, maybe we like the dog ate the manifesto. We don't have one. Please just vote for us anyway, because the colour blue is very nice. I don't know. I mean, can you imagine it?
I mean, to be fair, after your last experience, I suspect your manifesto will say as little as possible.
Yes, yes.
And it's not like you're going to implement everything in your last manifesto, is it?
Yes, no.
Half of that was junk as soon as the ink was dry.
Yes, no, indeed. Manifestos haven't done as well over the last couple of elections, I do admit. But you're up.
Manifesto, schmanifesto. Yeah,
but I suppose the serious point is, you know, is it going to be possible to have a united Conservative Party fight in the next election?
Mm. Mm. Well, I mean, I would say that from my experience, yes, because look at what happened to the Labour Party in 2017. You know, they spent 2016 literally tearing each other's eyes out. And then as soon as the election was called, everyone was like, right, get out, get on the doorstep, get the local MP elected, whoever they are, whichever side they were on. And unity and that kind of tribal strength does actually kick in when it comes to an election. Now, what's in your manifesto will be different, and there will be fights. Some people will want to see stuff in there that forces the hand of the next government. If they've got any sense, it'll be manifesto minimum. You know, the best manifesto it can be for the most people, which basically says vote Tory, yay. And that's
it. For a strong and stable government.
Yeah, they might want to stay away from those words. But yeah, I suspect that while I understand that that would be the fear, recent lived experience tells you that's probably not going to be the case.
But then Labour would have the same problem, because they managed to fudge the situation at the last election, because the Tories were so sort of hard and strong on Brexit. They were, by sort of stepping back from that and saying that's the wrong way, but not much else, they were able to pick up a lot of votes across the sort of spectrum below hard Brexit, which sort of helped them, among other things. But they would actually have to come up with something more substantial on what Brexit means and future relationships as well. So I think it'd be just as much a challenge for them.
Well, I think if it's a post-Brexit election, if we go to 2022, which I think we probably are, I mean, God, I think everyone's like, it's going to 2022, whatever else happens. I think that that's less of a challenge, because by that point, you guys have got the blame. The economy is probably tanked. So Labour will just be like, well, we can't be worse than this lot. We'll just pick up the pieces now, and you know, we'll implement our socialism in one country manifesto. And you know, by that point, I think people will be like, yeah, totally, whatever, do whatever you want. It can't be any worse than this.
Maybe. We'll see. We'll have to see.
So I think we'll have to see. So from one international disaster to another, Donald Trump has decided that no deal is better than deal. I can't imagine where he got that from. And obviously that's a really sensible thing to
well,
say.
Well, I'm actually going to stick up for the Trumpster on this. It partially anyway. And it's not just for debate purposes, but ultimately it's what he campaigned on. It was in his speeches. He said, this is what I'm going to do. And he's doing what he said he would do. So, if it's an awful, terrible thing or not, which, you know, it does look a bit dodgy, I have to admit. And I mean, essentially, if it's not dodgy, then he might deserve to win the Nobel Peace Prize if he happens to solve the Middle East and Iran through doing this, through this new way of diplomacy. And to be fair to him, all other forms of diplomacy haven't worked too well over the years. So who knows, this new tactic might work. But I mean, ultimately, he's doing what he said he would do. So we can't be surprised by that, especially as a lot of his campaigning was about politicians breaking the promises.
So if he also grabbed someone by the pussy, would that be okay? Because he's totally said that during the election campaign too.
No, that wasn't actually a campaign promise. That was just a sort of inbuilt
lifestyle. More of a campaign threat.
You know, if you want to get technical, it was a few years before the campaign. So it was some take the surface. So I mean, you know, I mean, look, I think the man is odious, and I could never vote for him for many reasons. He won the election, and he basically won it by saying politicians don't do what they say. I'm going to do what they say. And he said a bunch of stupid stuff, and now he's doing it. So, yeah.
I mean, what worries me is it's, I mean, the problem with that is that I didn't get a vote, but I will be affected if Iran starts building a nuclear program. So, you know, there's, of course, you can understand the politics of it internally in America. And I think you've made the best possible case you could possibly make for this, which is not one I think is massively overwhelmingly, like, politicians do change their mind sometimes when they have a mind to change. But, you know, I mean, it's just, first of all, his logic is so appalling. I don't want Iran to be able to build nuclear weapons in 10 years, so I'm going to rip up the deal that stops them building them now. Okay. And now I'm going to go make another deal with this other guy. Totally going to going to stick to that. That's my word is my bond. Except when it's not over here. So I just think it's such a bad. I think it may have been the last podcast where I said, you know, international diplomacy is like three-dimensional chess, and all Donald Trump's playing is hungry, hungry hippos.
But you know what? But hungry hippos might actually win at three-dimensional chess, because the three-dimensional chess wouldn't know what to do. They'd be so confused that the hungry hippos would eat all the pieces.
Yes.
I think, you know...
I've slightly lost my words on that one. I also did go and see the musical Chess the other day, and I'm trying to think of interesting...
Would you recommend?
It's a bit of a mess in the first half.
Okay,
it gets a lot better in the second half.
bit like this podcast, maybe. Anyway, we can't. I don't think, you know. I think it's a terrible thing to do it, but I can completely see why he did it, and I think we shouldn't be surprised that he's done it. And I think Macron going over there to say, you know, please don't do it, Monsieur President, and Theresa May ringing her up saying, you know, do you remember the good times when we wandered through the garden holding hands, Donald, you know, being his favourite? That was never going
to
work.
Boris
because,
Johnson,
you know,
flying to America to go on Fox and Friends.
Well, yeah, I mean, Boris going on Fox and Friends, I mean, that is absolute brilliance, isn't it? Not brilliance, but it's actually such a brilliant description of our times, you know, have to try and influence the president of the USA is to go on a TV talk news talk show is it shows you where we are. But he was never going to do it. He's a man of his word, and his words are I'm trying not to swear, but his words are sewer. But he's a man of his words. So, and all right, it affects us all, but and you know, the UN obviously, unfortunately, is not a place that deals very well with stuff at the moment because of other things as well, you know, Russia, and it's disturbing. I mean, all we can hope for, I suppose, is that all the other parties, Europe, China, all these other parties, basically keep the deal and essentially allow Iran to, you know, improve themselves economically, so they think, well, if US isn't doing it at the moment, then it's still okay, and so hopefully that will sort of help insulate the problem. But we can't be surprised that he did it.
No, I mean, I just think if you need a metaphor for current politics, think about the end of 1984. You imagine a boot stomping on the face for all eternity. If you need a metaphor for 2018 politics, imagine an appalling British diplomat appearing in front of a brain-dead morning panel for the rest of our lives.
I'm thinking George Galloway in a cat suit is a good metaphor for politics today, really. I don't know why.
Oh, innocent days.
Certainly
innocent
were
days.
Innocent days, weren't they? Yeah.
And on that bombshell, I think we should probably go and hug our families.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's great advice.
Thank you very much, Nick. And Mark, we hope to see you very soon.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
Just leaves it for me to say thank you very much to Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our theme tune. And this is a Political Human production.
Hi, I'm Emma Burnell, a political journalist.
Hi, I'm Steve Fielding. I'm Professor of Political History at the University of Nottingham.
And together, we do a monthly podcast called The Zeitgeist Tapes,
during which we talk about a film, TV show, anything to do with culture and its political implications.
We hope you'll enjoy it. Please do look for us on iTunes as The Zeitgeist Tapes. And if you do enjoy it, don't forget to rate and review.